Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Literacy View. We are so honored today to have our special guest, Dr. Kathy Rassel. And she is a researcher from the UK. Let me give you a little information about Dr. Rassel. Kathleen Rassel is a cognitive psychologist and professor of cognitive psychology at Royal Holloway, University of London, where she was previously the head of Department of Psychology. Her research has made fundamental contributions to understanding of reading and learning to read. Dr. Rassel has a strong interest in translating her research to improve policies and practices relevant to how children around the world are taught to read. She won the ESRC Celebrating Impact Prize for Outstanding International Impact in 2020. And we are so pleased to have her here with us today. She wrote a blog and she is part of the research study. Her blog is, let me just get that. What words do children encounter when they read for pleasure? And she wrote that with, I hope I'm going to say her name right, Maria Corachina. Is that correct? Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, yes.
So she co-authored it with Dr. Rassel. And she is part of this research study. And the article is The Children and Young People's Books Lexicon, a large-scale lexical database of books read by children and young people in the United Kingdom. And I have to say, when I saw your article and your blog, I was thinking how wonderful it is that you write a blog to translate the research for the average person. So I want to start off with that. May I call you Kathy?
Of course.
Okay. So Kathy, I want to start off with why you did start a blog, because I think it's so important. A lot of this research is sitting there and people who need to read it, the practitioners, really aren't going to pick up a research study usually. But something like a blog that's written in layman's terms, they will. So what got you to, you know, what made you decide to do this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I guess, you know, about 5 years ago, we wrote a big article on, which was called Ending the Reading Wars. And it was really aimed at trying to communicate the vast body of psychological knowledge about how children learn to read in a way that teachers and policymakers and the general public could understand. And at that point, I think there had been a view that for academic research, you know, we'll publish our research and then people will read it and they'll implement it. But actually, through that process of writing that big paper, we realized that academic research, you know, it's often written in a very, very sort of esoteric way. The papers are complicated. They've got a lot of numbers in them, a lot of statistics. And we found through writing that article, I mean, we couldn't believe how much impact that article ended up having. And I think a lot of it was really because we had written it in a way deliberately that people could understand. And I guess what it taught me is that, you know, if we want people to actually to read our work, for it to be influential, then we're going to actually have to work harder to make it accessible. And so one of the things I try to do now, not for all of our published papers, but for things that I think really have value outside of the academic community, I try with my postdoctoral scholars that work with me to try to communicate it in an accessible way, you know, either through a blog, through podcasts, maybe making a one-page summary that we send to policymakers. And it's actually a great skill for us too, because, you know, in this blog that we've written, it really helped me to think about what were the major insights of this project that we've done. What's important about it, right? What do I want to tell people? And when you try to write something in 750 words in a really accessible way, it forces you to really think about the essence of what was important about this piece of work that I really want people to know. So I think it's quite a good exercise for academics to engage in. It takes a lot of practice, but I think you're right, that we actually got quite a lot of hits on that blog. So I think many, many more people have read this work because we've made it accessible through the blog.
Yes. So there are also paywalls often on research. Yours is open access. So that's not the reason people won't read it, but often there are paywalls. And I know once I see a paywall, either I will just say, oh, well, I'm not going to read it, or I'll write to the researcher if I really want to see it. But most people aren't doing that. So Judy, since you are in the school system, in the New York City school system, and you coach, often you have to translate research to practice. What did you think of having this blog accompany the research for you?
I have to say it was really comforting. I even called Faith, I think, yesterday, and I'm like, Faith, I'm so happy that there's an article that breaks it down, because, you know, reading research is not easy for the practitioners in the classroom. Mm-hmm. We have our hands tied mm-hmm. with so many things to do. And, you know, it's so nice to have a blog written in a way that's very user-friendly and practical. But, you know, in general, that's what's been the greatest part of this whole adventure with the Literacy View. I mean, you know, for a while, researchers were just writing things and then it would be on social media for a day or two, but we're bringing research to life and having practitioners and researchers communicate together. I think that's been the missing piece in education for a very long time. And I think that as a result that has shifted, even as we saw recently with the phonemic awareness research that came out that was saying that we should connect letters and sounds much quicker, I was able to coach into that much faster than I would have if I would have had to, you know, wait or get approval or understand it. And I think that these conversations are really, really helpful. So I really appreciate it, Kathy. Thank you so much. It's much easier to get the gist in the blog version for a lot of us educators out there.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And thank you.
Yes. And I told you before, Kathy, before we even started, I read your article that you had written with Ann Castles and Kate Nation from Novice to Expert. I don't know of the exact title offhand, but that left such an impact on me because it was written in a way that was thorough but easy to understand. And I always recommend that article to every district I work with. That I think that's, to me, the go-to article. So thank you. And thank you for recognizing the importance of making it understandable for everybody. So let's dive into what exactly the article is. And this is so exciting. You talked about a database of books for children in the UK, specifically aimed at getting to a large number of words to hopefully expand children's vocabulary through books. And we know that conversational talk between kids or listening to TV won't do it, that the type of words in books is certainly more academic than what they'll hear on television. So could you talk about this database?
Yeah, let me just start by saying what the database is. So, you know, I think in the science of reading, often we think about, you know, we talk about how children, they read for pleasure, they read independently to get practice, and they learn a lot through doing that. They learn about words, they learn about word structures, et cetera. But we felt that nobody had really dug into what those words look like. You know, what's that experience look like? What are they encountering? And so to do that, we built this database, and the database is 1,200 children's books. The books are suitable for children from age 7 to 16. So really right on the cusp of when children are starting to read independently to when they're coming to the end of high school. And we built this in three blocks. So books for 7 to 9-year-olds, for 10 to 12-year-olds, and for 13 to 16-year-olds. and we analyzed the text in those books. And so altogether, those 1,200 books give us about 70 million words. Now, of course, lots of those words are repeated, but then we conducted a whole range of analyses of those words. And one of the things that you mentioned, Faith, that we've known for a long time that spoken language just isn't as sophisticated as written language is. But that really became clear when we analyzed the words in these books. So one of the things we found, for example, was that a vast proportion of the words in these children's books do not occur on British television. So we also have a very large database of television subtitles of everything that occurs on the BBC. So this is the British public broadcaster. And they have children's shows and adult shows. And about 20% of the words in the even the 13 plus corpus don't occur even on adult television, right? Which shows you just how sophisticated the language in these books is. And so I think, you know, in general, what we can immediately say is that books just provide a wealth of language experience that you wouldn't be getting, you know, on the playground or watching YouTube or watching television. And I could talk much more about the insights from the corpus as we go through the chat.
Mm-hmm. So, Judy, you have mentioned quite a number of times that children are not reading enough. They don't have books in their hand. They're not reading enough. And so this independent reading, I know, has been lost somewhat. But there's this issue of trying to balance it in school, not wasting classroom time, having kids read independently if they can't read. And what I love in Kathy's article is she starts off talking about the importance of phonics and morphological knowledge, that you can't expect kids to read independently unless they can actually read the words. So why don't you talk a little bit about what you're seeing in classrooms as far as how important the word reading is in order to get to that independent reading?
So, yes, I've been saying it for a while. I think that schools are in a transitional time right now. A lot of schools are adopting new programs, figuring out what their curriculum is going to look like. There's a balancing act right now with the knowledge building programs and the foundational skills portion of the day. And unfortunately, I think that I don't see enough books in children's hands right now, sometimes where they're actually physically really holding those books. I think there's been a lot of attempts right now. I do see a comeback of shared reading, which is great. I see a lot of isolated phonics, not enough of the application piece. And I think the application piece for children is so, so, so important. So I think that the way we use books has to be very intentional. Of course, there's books for joy and enjoyment, but there's also books that are meant to help kids learn how to read and crack that code, especially in the foundational period in their life when they're learning how to read. So I think intentionality is something that I think a lot of schools are thinking about more. What books are we looking at? And maybe those books that used to be independent on where the kids were just going randomly book shopping for leveled or patterned books has now shifted towards, okay, we're working on something in our phonics block. Maybe now independently, those kids are going to read something that they've had practice with in tier one with their teacher, right? We saw it as a shared experience. Now there's something that you may, you know, read independently or with a partner that you've been exposed to, and you have a better chance of A, being successful, B, it follows your scope and sequence when you're learning how to read. So I think intentionality is very important, but I think Kathy's article made a very interesting point. In a lot of those, and I hope I understood correctly, in a lot of those early readers, there's a lot of those words which are, I don't know what you termed it. Was it high frequency or high utility words?
Function words.
Yeah. So there's a lot of those function words. And I think the knowledge building component in the early years is very important as well, because those function words are not really deep comprehension words that are going to help kids with understanding. So I think it's a balancing act of making sure kids get better at those function words. And we know the science has changed on how we teach those words, right? We're not just having flashcards flashed all over the place. We're talking about what's regular, what's irregular. So I think good things are happening, but I think that whatever you've created where you're from in England would be very useful for us as well, because I think we're missing the boat.
I'm sorry, Judy.
That's more exposure here.
So, Kathy, could you share with us, because obviously these same issues are happening here in the United States. How does your work help us also? Because I see that that could be a missing piece for us as well.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to pick up on some of the things that Judy said, because, you know, she's right. If you don't have a good grounding in your phonics, you're not going to be able to read independently. And we know from the research that children who have good foundational reading skills, they choose to read more, right? So all this business about having a book in your hand, you don't have a book in your hand if you find it really hard to read, right? You have a book in your hand because you know reading is easy. You like it. It relaxes you. And the books in our database, they're all books that are bestsellers. They're not, you know, hard classics or anything. They're books kids read for enjoyment, right? And still, they're so sophisticated. And one thing that really, you know, surprised me in the analysis was, yeah, about 50% of the words in all books are the top 100 most frequent words. Words like the, from, with, and you know, you can learn those very easily. But they don't convey any meaning. In our 1,200 books, we have over 100,000 unique words, over 100,000 unique words that kids will be exposed to in writing. And you can imagine, you know, they're faced with these words they may never have seen before. They might not know the words. They need those phonics and morphological skills to be able to pull them apart. And, you know, I haven't much talked about morphology, but when we look at the words that don't occur on British television that are in these children's books, most of them are morphologically complex. They're words like outlandishly, unmysterious. And so you need those parts. You need to be able to pull them apart to use your morphology and your phonics knowledge to get to the meanings of those words. And that's why all that really good phonics instruction, the early explicit instruction, is so important. But Judy's right. You have to link that to the practice, right? You have to be retrieving those mappings, practicing all the time through this independent reading. And I think what our study shows is that even the books that are bestsellers, that kids are really enjoying reading every day out of school, they're good. They're good practice, right? They have a lot of richness in them.
So, Kathy, so how is this database being used? So the books are there. These are the books you studied. Are they used by teachers, school districts? Could you tell us a little bit about, are they recommended titles for parents to look for? How is it being used?
Well, let me tell you first about the books in the database. So the books we chose were based on bestseller lists in the UK. So they're based on Amazon bestsellers. There's all these literacy charities and websites that release lists of books for children that are not necessarily recommended, but they've been reviewed as good books, fun books to read. There's an organization called the National Literacy Trust here that does a big survey every year of the books children are reading and are enjoying. And so we included all those books. So these are just books that are popular today in Britain with children. And that's what we wanted to study, because we didn't want to study, you know, it doesn't make sense to say, oh, we're just going to study the classics, because we want to know what children are reading right now, today, in their homes. As for our database, you know, it was only published about 3 weeks ago, so it's not being used now. And we haven't made all the books available because those books are copyrighted. But what we have made available is our analysis of all the words in them. So, you know, what words occur in these books, at what ages, with what frequency, you know, how well are they spread across the books? And so we imagine principally that academic researchers will use the database for their own studies. But we really wrote the blog because the paper itself, because we've created this corpus, and there's a lot of what we call corpus linguistics methods, very technical methods in how we processed all the words, that can be pretty off-putting for a general reader. And that's part of the reason that we wrote the blog, because we wanted to be able to say, oh, this is why it's important. This is what we've learned from this. And of course, you know, one of the things we've learned is just what a challenge early reading is. You know, even if you've had great phonics instruction, you're still going to be meeting words in every book you read that you won't recognize, that you won't know. And those words will be different in the next book you read, right? So there's beyond those top 100 words, there's not a lot of overlap between the words you see from book to book. Lots and lots of new words, lots of opportunities to use your skills to pull apart words. So it's a huge challenge for even good readers, but it's also an incredible opportunity to build your language knowledge through these, you know, just very pleasurable books.
So here's a question for you, Judy. We had a conversation with Dr. Molly Ness, and she is very big on trying to get books spread to communities where they don't have access. And she talks about book deserts. So, you know, could you talk a little bit about, you know, how do you think children have access to books? Let's say where you're working, are they using the library? Are they do they have a lot of books in the home? What are we seeing now? Because even if they could read the words, do they have access to be able to get their hands on recommended books that have this rich vocabulary?
So after we taped with Molly Ness, and that episode is out now, the weirdest thing happened, Faith. Can I tell you what happened, ladies?
Yeah, please.
Magically, four boxes arrived in my building. I have no idea who sent them to my school. They're all the top read alouds for kids in first grade. Magically, I swear. I asked the AP. I said, did you buy these? I asked somebody else. Nobody knows, but the most magical, fantastic read alouds arrived after Molly was on our show and just in time for Kathy's episode. So I think I'll make a couple of people happy today. And it was so joyful because I think that, you know, a lot of these programs that are coming out, teachers feel like they don't have enough time for read alouds anymore because they're reading little snippets of things and not getting to just enjoy a book with that rich vocabulary. And, you know, schools are now in the implementation stage, and I'm sure I wish there was more implementation science out there, but, you know, teachers are saying we want to still do those read alouds. And I think it's important to not take them away and make that time. I think that, you know, teachers and kids are feeling really stressed. The literacy blocks are very structured, and we get that, you know, every piece of their day is intentional, right? We want kids to gain knowledge and learn how to read, but making that time for that rich vocabulary and those discussions are so important to all kids in all grades. So I think it's really important. I definitely think that I'm seeing more phonics-based decodables in kids' hands. I'm seeing schools ordering more intentional books that are books to learn how to read. But I'm definitely not seeing enough of books for enjoyment. I think there's a lot of confusion with kids that broke the code, what kind of books they can read independently. And I think that's a big danger right now in literacy. We're focusing so much on the kids that are trying to crack the code, but there's a lot of kids probably in each classroom that did crack the code, no matter what zip code you're in. And what do we and the screeners show it, right? There's the kids that are in the blue or in the high blue on something like Acadians. What are we doing for those kids? So I think access is important for every single child, and we need to raise the level of vocabulary for every child, whether they're, you know, independently reading or listening to reading or talking about reading.
Yes.
And, I think schools are struggling a little bit because I did see more book shopping. I'm going to be honest, in the balanced literacy days, I have to be honest. And, you know, my past was reading recovery. I haven't been in that world for like 7 years now. I'm in a very different headspace, professional space, and I'm really happy. But I definitely think that there's still work to do about talking about what kind of books kids are reading, what are schools doing with programs to make sure that kids get enough time to read? Because I think everything right now is very skill, get a skill, get a skill, get a skill, get a skill. But there's not a lot of focus on actually
reading. So Kathy, I love what Judy just said. What's happening in the UK? Because I could tell you here what Judy is saying, that's absolutely true. It's not just in New York City. I hear that in lots of states, this is a real problem. It's people are confused about how to balance all of this. Do you have recommended core programs? How does it work there? Because I know you have a strong, you know, phonics mandate, but what about the rest of the literacy block? How does that work there?
Yeah, well, I think the UK is in a bit of a better situation than the USA, and it's partly because the UK is smaller, and we have a national curriculum. So, you know, since about 2007, schools have been required to teach phonics, and then in 2012, a national assessment was brought in. So every child at the end of year one, so this is the second year of reading instruction, has to take a phonics screen to make sure that they do understand the code. And if they don't pass it, they get an intervention for the next year. So I think, you know, over the last 10 years, the phonics piece, that's really bedded in. And I think that there's a very good understanding of phonics, how to teach phonics. There's excellent practice. And I visit schools all around the country, and I'm always just astonished at the level of knowledge of teachers and how much that's improved in the last decade in early reading. I think the real challenge now is to think about, once you have that skill, how do you actually develop it to become a skilled reader? Because we know that just providing the high quality instruction, it's not enough. That's the first stage, right? It's necessary, but it's not sufficient, right? And you know, we have to figure out how we get from there to becoming really fluent comprehenders. And I personally think that one of the key areas is around fluency. So how do you get children being able to retrieve these mappings very, very rapidly? You want to be able to look at the word on the page, you know what it is instantly. So you can devote all that mental energy to thinking about the meaning, thinking about inferences, integrating background knowledge, right? And I think, you know, that's...
Kate, you're muted. Kathy, you're muted. Just so you know, we have a BS button, but we're not holding up the BS button. We're holding up the cheers button. We love, love, love what you're saying.
Just perfect. It's perfect. So tell us a little bit about...
I lost you just a bit.
Yeah, do you hear me?
I think I just lost you for a minute. Sorry about that. And I think one thing about the UK that's just very special is that there's now just a really tight, sort of symbiotic relationship between researchers and teachers. You know, there is a real sense of working together. And I learn a great deal from teachers when I go to schools. And so I just want to tell you, I visited a school in central London a few weeks ago, very deprived part of the city. And I was so impressed. In the first 45 minutes of every day, every class in that school, grades 1 to 6, they're doing their reading, right? In the early years, they're doing their phonics. In the middle years, they're working on their fluency. In the later years, they're doing their comprehension. And one of the things I loved is that in these later years, they're doing class read alouds for 45 minutes, and teacher has chosen a text, and they're picking on children to you read aloud, now you read aloud, now you, and the teacher will stop them. Oh, what did you mean by outlandish? What does that word mean? Right? And they've got a book that they're enjoying. They're high paced. Every child is reading aloud. So you don't have any of this silent reading, right? Silent reading, there's a place for silent reading, but probably not in instructional time. And so all these children are getting the chance to develop their fluency, to think about the meaning. It's high paced, it's high energy, very skilled teaching. And I was just so impressed that every single class in the school was doing this every day for 45 minutes. And the head teacher said, you know, if there's anything I can do, I'm going to teach these children to read, right? These children are going to get out of this school knowing how to read. And if you know how to read, this was a very disadvantaged, deprived area. You know, children are coming in with all kinds of challenges. But if you know how to read, that gives you so much of so much in terms of your life chances to make up for that, you know, that background you might have had. So, you know, I just thought, here's a school, they're not stopping at phonics, right? They're continuing on. They're trying to, and they're working with people like me to figure out what's the best way to turn these kids into skilled comprehenders. So I think that's kind of where the UK is at. And we also have, you know, we have a sort of structure where we have what's called research schools. And these schools are working hard to disseminate research and to understand it. We've got something called the English Hubs. And these are schools that are very, very good around literacy, that disseminate good practice. And they have other teachers at schools coming in to watch their practice. So I think it's a very, very positive environment in UK around primary literacy at the moment. And I often say, I think it's probably the best curriculum in the world for primary literacy.
This is fascinating.
Fascinating.
Judy, I just heard Kathy talk about the importance of fluency. Now, we had Dr. Tim Brzezinski on talked about the importance of fluency. Yet, it seems like the conversation here in the States has shifted to knowledge building, which we know is important, but it's as if that's the answer to everything now. That seems to be what's all over social media. And, you know, they've gotten away from other important aspects of reading, and they're focusing on just this content rich, which, of course, we know reading complex text is important. But are you hearing a lot about fluency? I'm not. What do you think, Judy?
Well, I love fluency. It's always been a big part of who I am as an instructor. And I think that, you know, with the science, I've gotten even deeper into it. I really talk to my teachers, what is echo reading? What is choral reading? What is reading on your own, working on phrasing and fluency? What are we doing for punctuation? So I think it's a really critical piece. And we know that phonics and fluency go hand in hand, right? If you can decode easily, then your fluency is going to be better. But it doesn't just work like that. Sometimes some students will need to see scoops of phrases on how to say more than one word at a time. So I think it's an area that definitely needs to be developed. I think that, you know, I live in a town that's actually very wealthy, and I'm noticing that a lot of the kids that I work with privately struggle with phrasing and fluency. So sometimes I actually take out my pencil and have to go into a book and draw scoops. And the kids will be like, Miss Judy, why are you writing in the book? I'm like, because I'm going to probably have 1,000 kids that need to work on fluency just like you do, you know, and sometimes I'm drawing brevs and macrons in there so that the kids know, like, to be flexible with their vowels or what to do when they see a vowel. I think fluency is really important. And of course, great fluency is going to help comprehension. I think that it's really important, and I'm going to say it loud and proud. I do believe in the 5 pillars of literacy plus writing. I think they're all very, very important. And I don't think that you can neglect one area and think you're going to have success without giving attention to them all. And so, writing too.
So, Kathy,
I have one question for Kathy, Faith.
It's on my mind. Are you following what's happening here in the States with the knowledge building and buying different programs? Well,
the same thing I was thinking.
Really? Okay. Are you following that? And what are your thoughts about that? As far as, you know, do you think that that's going to help? Is it something that is necessary? I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't follow the U.S. sort of dramas probably as closely as some people do. I think, you know, all of these elements are really important for becoming a skilled reader, right? And I think there is sometimes a tendency, and I've seen it particularly in the USA, I think it's because the USA seems to be quite polarized in many of the things that they do. That, you know, once you sort of say, okay, we're going to do science of reading, then it's going to be, oh, we're going to do just phonics, right? And I think, you know, there is a piece that says, oh, well, you know, there's lots of other things that are important too. You know, there's oral language, there's knowledge, there's et cetera, right? You can't just do one piece. And I think that that kind of polarized dynamic hasn't really happened in the UK so much. So we don't have these tensions between, you know, what you should do and what you shouldn't do. I think, you know, what I would say as a researcher and what we tried to convey in our novice to expert paper is that, you know, all of these elements of reading are important. Phonics, fluency, comprehension, knowledge, vocabulary, they're all important, but there's a time, a best time for those. So, you know, you've got to really focus on phonics in the first 2 years of reading instruction. Because if you don't, you know, if you don't get your phonics down, you're never going to be able to do comprehension, right? And I looked at some fluency data the other day from thousands of children that really showed that, you know, even though these children had had phonics instruction, by the end of year six, they really, really varied in their fluency, really varied. And so that just shows that, okay, we've got the phonics, but then we've got to do this other thing too. So I think, you know, there's a time and place for all of these things. I think it's not one or the other, but I would say that phonics has to take priority in the early years of reading instruction, right? It's not to the exclusion of everything else, but that's when we need to do phonics, right? But then it, you know, there's lots of other stuff to do during primary school to make sure that people are getting the knowledge and vocabulary and oral language experience that they require, the fluency, thinking about high level comprehension. All of that's important, but at a time and place. Just like, you know, I tried to learn how to play the piano as an adult, and I would go diligently to my teacher. You know, he would tell me how to do it, and then I'd come home and I couldn't do it. Right? I'd have to spend hours practicing. And that's, you know, that's kind of what reading is. It's, you know, we're telling them about the code. We're telling children about the code. Then they've got to practice. And they've got to, you know, just like in music, I've got to listen to a lot of music to understand the interpretation, how I'm going to convey this piece. And that's about my knowledge, my knowledge of the context, right? So that all comes, but none of it comes if I can't play the notes.
That's a big cheers. That was big cheers. Because
oh, good.
That was, we were cheering for you, Kathy, because here, it's, we don't really have people prioritizing. It's this idea that in kindergarten, first and second, yes, we have to do phonics, but there's a lot of the conversation is about building knowledge at the same time, which of course you can. I'm not saying you can't, but you can't do everything well. You can't, you know, devote the same amount of time to everything. And kids have to learn to lift the words up off the page. They have to be able to do those things. Judy, we've had these conversations before. You asked about strategies, reading strategies. Some of that has to come with oral language, right? Like talking about books and talking about how to listen to a book with strategies. They can't do it on their own in kindergarten and first.
Faith, why don't you just ask Kathy how she feels about strategies?
Okay, I will. There's a lot of...
Let's just hear what she has to say.
I just have to preface this by saying there is certainly research on reading strategies in comprehension. So a certain set of core strategies. How do you feel about learning this set of core strategies? Is it helpful? Is there a certain time when you feel it's better to implement these strategies?
Oh, that's a tricky one because I'm not a comprehension expert. So I want to say that at the outset. I think, you know, looking at one of the things that's happened in the UK around reading comprehension, I think reading comprehension is a very difficult problem. I think we don't fully understand reading comprehension. We don't understand how to teach it. And we certainly don't know how to assess it very well. Like the different measures of comprehension don't tend to hang together very well. And one of the things that's happened in the UK is that we have certain national assessments of reading comprehension at the end of year six, and these pick apart different aspects of comprehension. So they might look at sort of vocabulary, they might look at inferencing, and those different aspects are awarded different marks, right? So you might get 40% of your marks are on inferencing and 20% are on this aspect. And what that's led to is kind of a compartmentalization of the way that these aspects of comprehension are taught, right? So you'll have your inferencing sort of lesson, and you might even have a school say, well, almost all the marks are going to this aspect, so let's just focus on this, right? Which doesn't really get at the holistic aspect of comprehension. And I think, you know, it might be in that case, that's a strategy to try to do well in the exam. But in that case, the nature of the exam is really driving the nature of the instruction, which is not really what we want to see. I think the extent to which these strategies are typically metalinguistic, you know, they're explicit. I think the research is mixed at the extent to which these are useful for different children. And I sort of want to take a view on that, particularly because I don't know the US context. But I would say that I think it's dangerous to think about comprehension in terms of different component parts that can be instructed separately and assessed separately. And I think, you know, in some ways, this is where the knowledge aspect comes in, right? So just to give an example, you know, one of the reading comprehension questions on our last year's national exam for sixth graders talked about the state of Texas. And of course, for Americans, and I'm American, that's easy, right? But most English kids don't know what a state is, right? Because we don't have states here, right? So that's a really simple concept for you and me. But if you don't have that knowledge, you're never going to be able to answer that question, right? And it was almost like it was just passed over in the exam. You know, whoever wrote this exam just didn't recognize that some children might not know what a state is, right? So I think that that's where these areas of knowledge, whether it's in your history curriculum or your science curriculum, they can start to impact on your reading comprehension. And so I think it's important that we don't forget. And to a certain extent, this is just about oral language. You know, it's about your being in the world and how that integrates with the skills that you're building for reading.
So I think here the issue is researchers who do specialize in thinking about strategy instruction do it through that complex text, that it's not, they're saying it should not be taught in isolation, like 1 week we're going to work on main idea. It's having this core group of strategies that you use to understand what you're reading. So it starts with the book, it starts with the text, but that children are using this type of language and understanding how to read deeply. So I think it's something that's the old way of thinking about it, like, okay, I'm going to teach main idea and next week we're going to work on inference and forget about it. It's an interrelated way of looking at strategies, but using these books, rich books, rich complex books, to be able to read it in a deeper way. Judy, you look like you had something you wanted to say. Did you want to jump in or no? I thought that you had a question. I have a question for you. Do you have package programs in the UK? Do you have something that is marketed for building, you know, like basal readers and you know, different types of books that are collected together that teachers are supposed to use to build knowledge, to build vocabulary, to build comprehension? Do you have that there?
I wouldn't say so, certainly not to the same extent in the US. And I think this is it's one aspect of the dynamic in the US that concerns me, that there are these sort of mega publishers, and a lot of the poor practice, I think, has been driven by, you know, schools not knowing what to buy and the marketing strategies of different publishers. And that's not something that we've faced so much in the UK. And so what we have in the UK, we have a number of phonics programs. And in order to be, there's a process through the Department of Education where these phonics programs can be validated. And in order to be validated, they have to meet certain criteria, right? So they have to teach the code in a systematic way. There have to be decodable readers. Those programs range from being free, and the government put out one that's free, to ones that are more costly. But schools can choose what they use. There are now a lot of schools that are making up their own programs. So I know of two sets of schools that have made their own phonics programs that are absolutely wonderful, right? And they've gone to get them validated. I know of one school where they even have the children doing the illustrations for their own phonics books, right? I mean, fantastic. And so that's the phonics scope. Some of these programs are now extending into fluency. So there's a group of schools called the Wandle Trust in the UK. They have a phonics program that's very well used. They have a partnership with a publisher, and they've recently released a whole series of fluency books that are not only suitable for children of different fluency areas of achievement. So, you know, as children get more skilled, new books become suitable for them. But the books are also written so that they kind of look like the children. Like there's books for that boys might like. There's books with a lot of ethnic minorities, with people from different backgrounds. So they're books that are designed to appeal to the demographic that the schools are reaching. And so I think that's really positive. I looked through all the books over the last few weeks, and I think they're beautiful. So those sorts of books are being developed. They're often sold not for profit, so it's part of a charity. So the schools will sell them at cost. But we certainly don't have these big publishers selling very expensive programs to school districts. So there's not that kind of a market here. And I think that that market, I think it's really distorting for schools trying to do the right thing, trying to follow the evidence, et cetera. So it's something that frustrates me about what's happening in the USA.
Me too. And I think that's a major, major problem. Judy, again, we've talked about this, where there are three programs that New York City had to choose from. And it's, you know, the publishers are all kind of pushing a certain program that they're saying this is the curriculum. But we were talking about teacher knowledge and being able to know what's important and when to teach it. And, you know, it looks like.
And how.
So, you know, this is a very different scenario, what I'm hearing in the UK, from what we have here.
And I think, you know, whenever people have something to sell, you know, I always say that, you know, you can take what I say and you can evaluate it, but I don't have anything to sell, right? So when someone has something to sell, you know, it complicates the relationship between the school and the researcher and what the expertise is.
Yeah. Do you still have leveled books in the classrooms? I know you call them book bans. You have leveled books in the classroom?
Yeah, some of the phonics schemes come with the decodable readers are in. I'm not sure that it's leveled in the same way that they are in the US, but they're colored. So if you're doing your first batch of GPCs, then that will be for a certain level of that would be for the red books, right? So then you'll take a red book home to practice those GPCs. But I'm not sure that's the same thing that you're talking about.
No, it's not. I'm talking about the ones that have predictable words. And
I see mom, I see dad, I see chickens, I see roosters, I see hens.
No, we don't have those. Those are predictable, right? So that's what we used to have when we used to sort of read by guessing, right? So
yes,
and here they call it searchlight. the multi-queuing where you have the pictures and it's just, it's the, I forget what they're called in the US, but yeah, when you have the repetition and then you can guess what, you know, I see a dog, I see a cat, I see a hippo, and you're just pulling out the pictures. No, I mean, those don't teach you to read, right? You actually need to not guess from the pictures. You need to be able to practice your decoding.
Yes. So here, that seems to be going out, the guided reading with the leveled books. But what's being replaced right now, what schools are doing is jumping on this idea of getting, whether it's a basal or curriculum, content-rich curriculum. I mean, it goes under different names, knowledge-rich curriculum. But they're getting this to, you know, in K all the way up. And it's being pushed a lot by publishers. Mm-hmm. And so there's a market that went from the leveled book into this. Yes.
And I think initially it started out with really good intentions because in the US, we've had really low literacy scores for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. So I think policymakers were really hoping that, you know, this was going to fix or help schools. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, you know, I think that it can help, but it was a very speedy process. Mandates happened very quickly. Evidence wasn't looked at as carefully as it probably should have been. And actually, one of the programs that has the highest evidence wasn't one of the ones that was even an option. So it is definitely an interesting time. Kathy, I had one question for you. So in the US, we have a lot of multilingual learners, which definitely it's not a problem. It's a wonderful thing, but it definitely makes the literacy landscape look a little bit different. We have a lot of dual language classes. We have multilingual classes. We have kids learning how to do phonics in English. Then they're doing it in a different language. We also have, I've also seen in the field, knowledge building programs. The kids hear it once in English, then they're hearing it again in another language. So what's going on over there where you are?
It's a lot.
Yeah. What? Yeah, I think that that's such a fascinating area. And there's not a lot of research on this. I mean, the research has really been focused on English monolingual contexts. And I do a lot of work with the World Bank, looking at reading in low-income countries. And of course, this is a big issue in those countries because they're learning, often learning to read in a language that they don't know. And they're learning in a multilingual context, right? So this happens in the US, it happens in the UK. And I think, you know, for learners who are learning to read in a second language, that does pose a challenge because, you know, as we know from the simple view of reading, you know, we're expecting children to come into the classroom with a degree of spoken language that they can map these new printed words onto. And that's more difficult if you're learning to read in a second language. But I think it shouldn't be a total impediment. And I want to just recount, I talked about the school that I visited a few weeks ago in inner London. Now that school is in a very disadvantaged area. Almost every child in that school is English as an additional language, right? Almost every child. And that school is scoring 20% above the national average in terms of their reading outcomes. And it's partly because they're, you know, they're so disciplined about every day, the first 45 minutes is reading, very high quality instruction suitable for the age of the child. And I think, you know, what the head teacher told me was that these children come in with kind of, I wouldn't say language weaknesses, but, you know, they don't have the background knowledge, partly because of their level of disadvantage, also because they don't speak English as their main language at home. They don't have the language knowledge. So that is, you know, they're not going to be like, you know, the best private school in the country, right? And in England, we have some pretty posh boarding schools. But what this head teacher says is that if I can teach these children to read, then that gives them the tools to acquire that knowledge, right? So once you have the skills for reading, you can read books and you can get the knowledge that you might not be getting at home or through your other activities. And I think, you know, just coming back to our paper, what really astonished me was that these are just silly books that the children are reading, and they're so sophisticated, right? So, you know, they're offering such a challenge, but also such an opportunity, right? So you don't have to buy really expensive programs, right? But beyond your phonics, if you get the phonics right, you don't have to buy these really expensive programs with the right language content in the books. Just get some books, right? Just get some books, some bestsellers off Amazon. What our paper shows is that these have rich vocabulary in them. Even books like we have a series called Diary of a Wimpy Kid, right? I always think these are so low level. Actually, it's got quite good vocabulary in it. We've got an author called David Walliams who writes just silly books, Gangsta Granny. It's got great vocabulary in it. Children like it, right? So I think that you don't have to be swayed by lots of publishers about which readers to buy. Beyond your phonics, you've got some decodables. Then, you know, there's a wealth of children's books out there today. And the language content in those books is just fine. Children like reading them. It's sophisticated. It will give them vocabulary that's not on TV and not in their spoken language experience. So I would encourage teachers to, you know, keep upping your professional training, your continuing professional development, but then trust these instincts. That's once you've given children the tools for reading, you've given them that high quality instruction and the opportunities to practice through decodables, you know, then they can be guided through just the rich children's book landscape that there is available.
Faith, can I ask Kathy one more question? Mm-hmm. Kathy, what about technology usage? I see a big uptick in intervention and literacy programs that are digital for kids. What's going on where you're at with that?
I don't know much about that, actually. And there's burgeoning literature trying to look at digital interventions, digital, you know, reading on a tablet. For me, I personally just can't get used to it, right? I like to have the book in my hand. And I think, you know, I think about my own children, I like them to have books in their hands, partly because if they're reading on a tablet, they're too... they're tempted just to go onto YouTube, right? You know, it's a attention sapper. But I think that the research is still to do. I mean, one thing I would say is certainly in, you know, a lot of places, you mentioned the term like book deserts. I mean, this is a big problem in some of the lower income countries. Actually, technology offers a really, really amazing opportunity because, you know, lots of people have smartphones. And with the technology, the translation tools we've got, it means you can translate some of this lovely children's literature into other languages to kind of, you know, spread literacy more widely. So I think there's probably pluses and minuses, but, you know, I think the research just probably hasn't been done to make a definitive statement on that.
So Kathy, to wrap up, you know, you said so many interesting things. One thing that really stood out to me was how you said researchers and teachers have developed this lovely relationship in the UK. And it's respectful and that they're getting their information directly from you. And you are able to see firsthand what's going on in the schools. I would love for that to happen more here in the United States, rather than depending on people who have very little teaching going on, they're not researchers, they're not professors, but they do a lot of talking about what should be in the schools and, you know, people following blindly, just thinking that they have the answers. And I feel like it's another Sold a Story in the making that's happening here. But what you're talking about, you know, having teachers really know their stuff, how to teach phonics very well in the early grades, sharing books, lots of read alouds with lots of high level vocabulary, making sure they're fluent, working their way up to really sophisticated comprehension using this rich complex language, that shows to me that there's a respect for the research that I think here we talk about the science of reading, but I don't know if we're really following it. It's like a label here. I don't know your feelings about that, but I would love to wrap up with maybe last words about that from you.
Yeah, well, I would say that it's been, I think, you know, in the UK, one of the transformational aspects of my career was the development of a grassroots movement called Research Ed. And I think they do have it now in the US. But it was a group of teachers that started meeting on a Saturday in schools. And I started hearing about this. And I thought, I think I might just go along and listen. I wanted to learn, you know, what do teachers know? You know, what do they think the problems are? So I started going to these meetings and just sitting at the back and listening. And of course, I felt like, oh, I'm not a teacher, so I don't really belong here. But that what I learned at those meetings really helped me to think about how to write that novice to expert paper, right? It told me what I thought teachers knew wasn't what they knew, right? And what I thought they wanted to know wasn't what they wanted to know. So part of that was listening. And I guess then through that, being able to develop these really trusting relationships where it used to feel like, oh, well, I would disseminate the research to teachers, but now it's much more collaborative, I think. And, you know, so I'll go into a school and I'll say, oh, I'd like to know how you approach the problem of fluency, right? And I'll watch and it'll give me ideas that I can then take into the lab and study. And I think that, you know, I think that you mentioned the word respect. It is this community of respect because, you know, I'm quite aware that I'm a laboratory scientist, right? What I study in the lab under really controlled circumstances is not necessarily going to work in a classroom. And you know, the other thing I've learned is that, you know, even though you get a significant effect in the lab, it doesn't mean it's scalable or feasible or acceptable to a teacher in a classroom. So I think, you know, understanding those two environments has been a really important part of the kind of last 5 or 7 years of my career. And most of what I do now, you know, every time I go into a school, I get lots of new ideas, right? I get ideas about what the key questions are, what should be studied, how it should be studied. And I've even got collaborations now with teachers to try to figure out problems together. So I think that, you know, for me, that's been the really, really positive change in the field in Britain. And I know that that's possible in the US too, because I know that there's a lot of reading researchers who would love to have more contact with teachers. So I guess for the teachers listening, what I'd say is that, you know, email a researcher. You know, if you're interested in research, just email someone. Because when I get an email from a teacher, I'm always like, oh gosh, somebody wants to read my stuff, right? Of course, you know, they ask for a paper, I'm going to send them all papers, right? So I think, you know, researchers are really interested in collaborating with teachers. So I'd encourage people to reach out and to try to force. And I think it's a really positive part of the story here, and it can be for the US as well.
Yeah, so I think that's what this show is about, honestly, that the Literacy View really loves their researchers. And we love hearing from you. And we love having them share what they know and trying to bridge that with teachers, the schools, and parents, because otherwise there's a lot of BS messages going on under the label of SOR that's not necessarily science. We want to hear from people like you firsthand. So we thank you so much for joining us. Judy, I don't have any other questions. I just would love to have a database of titles that we know American children like, and we could kind of emulate what they're doing in the UK. I think that would be fabulous. Maybe, Kathy, you could contact somebody here and have a collaboration, because I think it's necessary. I really do. Judy, yeah, anyone?
Sure.
Cheers to Kathy. Cheers to all the researchers. We love you. And we know that the researchers love us too, because, you know, we have no publishers. We're not working for a publishing company. We're just teachers, educators in the field still doing the work. So we are so lucky to speak to people like you, Kathy. We are honored. And follow us on theliteracyview.com, our website. It's getting better and better every day. Follow us on Instagram, The Literacy View. Follow us on Apple Podcasts. Write us a great review and cheers. Good things are happening. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much.